From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Craig Cohen in for David Inge this hour. Our technical director is Jason Croft. Our producer is Harriet Williamson. In this hour of the program, we welcome your questions about computers. It's a topic that we take up each month on the first Thursday of the month. Whether you are on the lookout for a new computer, have questions or concerns about online security, or need some troubleshooting advice, we have a couple of guests with us here to help you out. Debbie Flieger is a network engineer for Campus Information Technologies and Education Services, or CITES, here at the University of Illinois. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. And Jim Irick is a security engineer at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
And we welcome you to the conversation as well. You can call us with your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And I want to start off right off the bat with a little discussion about LinkedIn. We've learned that the site says some users' passwords have been stolen and leaked onto the internet. LinkedIn isn't saying how many of the more than 6 million passwords that were put online were tied into accounts on the networking site. And the company says it continues to investigate the breach. What do we make of this, Jim?
Well, obviously they had some problems. But from what I've read and talked to other security people, is it's not completely terrible because they can't. There is no mapping right now between the files that were leaked to the internet or the passwords that were leaked to the internet and people's accounts. So they can't say, aha, I have your password hash, I'm gonna now reverse it, and I can log into your account. That's not true. It was password hashes, not passwords. Password hashing is a little bit of encryption. It's not actually encryption, it's hashing. But basically, it makes it so you can't actually know what the person types in from the hash necessarily. Mm-hmm. The problem is that hash space is smaller than password space, so that there you can actually have multiple passwords equal the same hash, which is okay when it's just on a system and people would have to randomly guess. But what you can do is you can actually calculate. You can take what it's called a rainbow table, where you know that this password equals this hash. And so then I can go, aha, I have that hash in this password file, so now I know a password that works for that.
I guess the bottom line is, can someone take these passwords and figure out whose account this is and break into it?
Not that I've heard so far.
Okay.
In general, this brings up stuff about passwords that we've talked about on previous shows. For instance, I think at least the last time I was on, when I heard about the LinkedIn, the passwords being exposed, I was not concerned because 2 months ago I spent a pretty large amount of time and went to every website that I have an account on and changed every one of my passwords to something different and random for every service that I subscribe to. And therefore, I'm like, oh, okay, they got my LinkedIn password. But that doesn't work anywhere else for me. So, and they still can't map it. But even if they had my username and that password, the only thing they could have affected of mine was LinkedIn. And then yesterday I went in and just changed my LinkedIn password to a new and random password.
Debbie, how do you keep track of a bunch of different random passwords if you're going to change everything that you have? I mean, a lot of us, and this is probably about as unsecure as you can get, if that's the appropriate word, write it down on a sheet of paper somewhere and keep track of our passwords there because there's so many of them.
That's a perfectly good way to keep track of passwords that are only likely to be compromised on the internet. So if you've got that list at home for all your personal stuff, only somebody who breaks into your house can get that list. Now, don't do it at the office, right? You've got the janitorial staff. You've got, somebody walks by who's visiting a coworker. People you have no idea could look around on your desk for that list. That's never a good idea in like a work environment or an open place. But for your personal stuff at home, who can get, think about who can see that list. You, your spouse, your kids, that's probably about as large as that list goes. Hopefully you trust those people. If you don't write it down where they can find it. But writing it down on a password for personal accounts kept at home, because all the hacking comes in over the internet, right? That's actually pretty safe. Now, you still have to remember them because you want to carry that list with you. Now, that gets into a little more issue. So there's software solutions for that. There's a handful of really well-known password programs, password database stores that store your passwords encrypted. And when you go to the right website, it prompts you to type in a master password that you do have to remember, and it'll fill in your random password for you. I use a program like that. Jim, you've got a different solution. You keep them on a USB key separate, so it's not even stored on your hard drive, right?
Well, right now it's actually in my Google Drive.
Okay.
When Google came out with their cloud storage synchronized across multiple platforms, multiple computers, I actually gave that a go instead of carrying around a USB key with my password file on it, which is how I was doing it before. So I'd plug it into a computer, go open the file, type in the master password, and then it would give me access to all my various passwords and account information. Right now I actually have it. I moved it to Google Drive so that it's instantaneously updated on all the machines that I sit at and work on. It's still encrypted in the cloud, so yes, it is stored in the cloud. However, it's encrypted with a strong password, so theoretically, even if somebody got a hold of that file, they're not going to be able to open it. I will say also that Campus provides one of these programs. It's called Password Vault. And that is available through, I believe, the site's web store.
This is Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Craig Cohen, sitting in for David Inge this hour, and my guests are Debbie Flieger, and Jim Irick from the University of Illinois. Debbie works for Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services, or CITES. Jim works for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And they are here to answer your questions about computers, from what to look for in a new computer to online security concerns to basic troubleshooting advice. They stand ready to assist. Phone number to call is 333-9455, or you can call us toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So you mentioned the cloud. I know more and more folks are moving towards that. There's still a part of me that's feeling a little uncertain about putting files that I've created, things that are mine, that I feel like I own in some way, out there where someone else maybe could get access to them, or saying instead of storing them on my own devices at home, putting them out on the cloud. What are some of the pros and cons of doing that?
And I don't disagree with those things. I use my cloud space as a convenience for moving small files or data things between platforms, between a laptop and a desktop. So for me, the cloud has become, right now at least, when it comes to cloud storage, it's replaced a USB key. Have I ever trusted a USB key with the only copy of important information? No, because just this week I had one stop working, and I end up, and it got bent in the USB drive, or in the slot, and when I pulled it out and put it back in a different machine, it wouldn't come online reliably, so I ended up trying to get a little bit of data off of it, and then I cut it in little pieces and threw it in the trash. So for me, it's just a replacement for now. I don't even have to carry up a physical anything in my pocket and plug it into a machine and hope that anymore we don't have to worry about it. But, you know, at one time with Windows XP or older, we even had to worry that it would even open, that your machine had the right drivers. Now I have a high-speed network connection. I can just have access to it. So, I still keep my important files backed up on my desktop, which has a backup that runs every day or continuously, depending, like if you have the Mac that has the wonderful built-in Time Machine. There are alternatives that you can purchase for Microsoft for that, for Windows products.
What is a Time Machine?
So Time Machine, Debbie can tell you more. She's the Mac person mostly. So
Time Machine is the built-in backup program that comes with your Mac. If you plug in a hard drive and you haven't previously set up a Time Machine backup drive, the first thing it'll ask you is, do you want to make this your Time Machine drive? Use an empty drive or a drive you don't care what's on. Tell it yes. It'll reformat it and set it up. And as long as that USB drive is connected, and every time you plug it in thereafter, it will do automatic backups every hour of any changes that you've made to any files on your system. And then it compresses things on a daily and then weekly and yearly format. But until your hard drive runs out of room, it'll keep every change you've made. So if you accidentally throw something away, or even you make a change to a file and you hit save and realize, oh, shoot, I didn't like that. How do I get that back? And you can't undo it for some reason. You can go to that Time Machine backup and, using a very finder-like interface, looking in folders of actual files, find what you want and tell it to restore. And it'll say, do you want to replace it or do you want a duplicate? And there you've got it back. But you don't have to do anything other than the one time say, yes, I want to use Time Machine when you plug in the hard drive. And it just goes all the time.
You mentioned hard drive space. How full should a hard drive be? Is there a point at which you say after this certain percentage, you really shouldn't continue to add files? You need to start to reduce it?
So for attached to your computer? For your regular hard drive, not a backup drive?
Regular hard drive on your computer.
But, well, both Mac and Windows these days have an optimization program built in to, you know, I don't know, for those of you that have been around a long time, you used to run a disk optimizer and you'd sit and you couldn't use your computer for a while it removed all the files around and opened up the free space. They do that automatically. Both platforms do that these days. I don't know that Linux has something like that. I think you're a little more on your
own. We've
also
gone to the newer versions of file systems are not as they just aren't. It doesn't cause a problem anymore like it used to.
So they kind of clean up on their own, but those cleanup programs don't work if your drive's too full. So if I'm down to under, say, 1 gig of free space on my hard drive, it gets very sluggish and doesn't work very well. If I'm over 5 or 6 gig of free space, it usually works just fine. And so that would be my experience on Mac OS 10.6 and 10.7. You need at least 5 gig of free space on your hard drive.
I'd agree with that. On a Windows box, it starts complaining and getting to be about the same thing. So in general, I mean, so you have a computer with 250, 500, or even a couple of terabyte drive in it. 5 gig that's a very small amount of that drive that's left empty. So you can fill them up a lot now.
How often should you defrag your computer?
You don't have to anymore.
I don't think I've run defrag on Windows 7 since I've owned it.
The 10.5, 10.6, 10.7, I've never run a defrag. They built that into the OS. It automatically kind of does it in the background for you as you do things.
What happens when it's doing that?
So the issue with fragmentation is your hard drive is just like a lot of shelves in a library. And fragmentation is where it finds spare space. Let's say we have a big thick book, and there's no space on the shelf for that thick book to sit in one place. So we tear that book up into multiple pages, multiple sections, and we stuff them into the holes we can find. Well, now when we want to go read that book, we read section the first one, and then it says, "Oh, now you got to go to this shelf and read the next section." And then we finish that one, and it says, "Oh, go to this section and read the next section." So defragging basically reorganizes everything so all the books are together in one piece in the same place on the shelf. And it's basically the same thing for your hard drive as what we used to do. So the hard drive, what it would do is it would clear out a space of the hard drive, write a big giant file there, so then that left spaces elsewhere, and it would just keep doing that. And I remember running things like that for 16 hours at a time or longer. I mean, it was just forever. Especially the more full your hard drive got, the slower it got because it had less space to work with. It's kind of like some of those little puzzles where you're going to move the piece into the blank spot and you move stuff around. So if you have half blank spots, it's very easy to organize it. If you only have one blank spot, it's more difficult. And so I remember on old Windows 95 machines and things like that, it would just take, you would run it over the weekend, you know, things like that. Right. Or you would actually have it run a little bit every night. So it would kind of keep up. Anymore, it's just, like I said, I think I've not done a lot of research into it, but I know that they've optimized the file systems so that it's less of a problem. Some of the stuff, the systems optimize in the background automatically. And another reason is that we have plenty of speed in our computers anymore. I think, in general, we have a lot of, people call it bloat. Since now we buy machines with 4, 8, 16 gig of RAM in them, terabytes of hard drive space, we just don't penny pinch our system resources like we used to.
Well, that's true with new computers, and if you've bought a new computer in the last year or so. But, Debbie, what about folks who hang on to the same computer for a decade? And there are folks out there that do that, and they just sort of coax it along.
You have to be a lot more careful. If you've got a 10-year-old computer, you know, you've got to be a lot more aware of what the 10-year-old tools were. You know, what we're talking about for the last 2 or 3 years doesn't necessarily apply to the operating systems your 10-year-old computer can run. If you're running a 10-year-old computer and it can, you know, you might be better off to run Linux or something simple like that, because trying to run Windows 7 on a 10-year-old computer is just not going to work, because the performance that the hardware has to do to make those operating systems run just isn't there. So if you've hung on a 10-year-old computer and you want to keep using it, then you've got to be more willing to spend time learning how to run your computer. If you can swap it out for a newer one, you can give it less attention.
Is there an advantage to hanging on to older computers using older operating systems? Or is it just, you know, you got to keep up with the times and you should always just have the latest and greatest?
Not if they're on the internet. So there are definitely security concerns, not to mention features. that so you can't get the newest stuff if you're running older machines. Some eventually things just won't run. Microsoft Office, I believe, at one point just said, okay, we're not, you can't install this on an older operating system. And Internet Explorer, I think, did the same thing. But the concern that I would have more is that eventually operating the companies, either whether it's Apple or Microsoft, or even if it's Linux stuff, they stop the people that develop and maintain those and fix security holes and other performance problems and things. They say, okay, this is too old. We need to just move on and only work on our new stuff. Apple's policy is to only support the last two, or the current one and the last build. So right now, Lion and Snow Leopard are officially the only Mac operating systems that Apple releases security patches for. Every once in a while, I'll see one come through that still applies to Leopard, I think.
It's pretty rare.
But it's rare. So, you know, definitely an Apple is, I mean, and they bring out a new operating system, what, every 18 months?
Just about.
So basically, if you're running an operating system 3 years old or older on an Apple, you are potentially exposed to problems on the Internet. Now, if you never have it on the Internet and you just use it at home and it's not connected and you never surf the web, I have less concerns about that, because who's going to get it, you know, who's going to come in and hack into it if it's not connected to the network? It's pretty secure then. But most people would find a computer not connected to the Internet not very useful.
The biggest exception to that is if you've got a purpose-driven computer. There are places on campus even that have, like, really fancy microscopes that, you know, there's this really special card that got built 10 years ago that's the only way to pull the data out of that microscope. And so they still have to run the old 10-year-old computer, or the card doesn't work. We work with them, the security office and networking places work with them to either keep those computers off the network for all the reasons Jim just mentioned, or to put a security device like a firewall in front of it to provide the protection that the operating system doesn't work. But unless you've got a use like that, there's really seldom a benefit other than the fact it doesn't cost you any money to keep using an old computer.
Now, Microsoft has Windows XP simply won't die. I think Windows XP support is still still set to be Microsoft rolling out security patches until 2014. At least if I'm reading the Microsoft webpage correct. So, you know, that's a long time. But I still personally wouldn't feel safe surfing the Internet on an XP machine today. That's my feeling. It's too old. Even if they are doing patches for it, it's only the ones as they find them. So there's potentially stuff in there and people just aren't paying attention to XP as much. But the hackers may, things like that, because there's still a lot of XP machines out there. So, you know, I think Apple's policy, 3 years, 4 years, that seems longer than that. And it's time to upgrade at least the operating system. Maybe not the hardware, because, I started out, I think one of my Macs came with Leopard, and I have Snow Leopard on it, but I could put Lion on it. It would run fine. So it's not like I had to replace the hardware. Just upgrade the operating system. And Apple's operating system upgrades aren't, it was $25 to go to Snow Leopard from Leopard, and I don't know what it is to go to Lion.
Lion was, I think, $29 was the retail price. Cheap. They do try to make them affordable because they do expect you to upgrade them.
Right.
You're listening to Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Craig Cohen, sitting in for David Inge during this hour. We are very much live, and we welcome your questions this hour for our guests about computers. With us is Debbie Fleiger and Jim Irick from the University of Illinois. Debbie works for CITES, the Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services unit of the U of I. Jim works for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. They're here to answer your questions about computers, from what to look for in a new computer to online security concerns, any basic troubleshooting advice you might be looking for. Maybe you are one of those folks trying to coax along an older computer. Maybe your computer's acting up a little bit. Well, we welcome your phone calls this morning at 333-945 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Is now a good time to buy a new computer? Debbie?
Jim said no a few minutes ago, and I wanted to hear why. So
no, at least not laptops. And I think a lot of this applies to desktops, too. So Microsoft has their Worldwide Developers Conference coming up soon. And they tend to announce new hardware at that. And the rumor mill says that there are MacBook Pros in the lineup, and even Mac Pros, the desktops. And even if you don't want to spend the money for the very best one, often as soon as Apple announces one of those things, announces the next model, they will start lowering prices to cut inventory on the previous model to get them out of the store so they can make room for the new stuff. So until after Apple announces those and we see where the prices go and what the features are on the new stuff, I would hold off. I mean, it's not very long away. I think it's next week or the week after.
So you just want to sort of time the price opportunity.
Absolutely. And then Intel, so on the Windows side, Intel is releasing and new desktops laptops are coming out using their new, I believe it's called the Ivy Bridge chipset, which adds a lot of features. It's not just like an incremental update from the, I think, Sandy Bridge chipsets. It has a lot of new stuff, and I think it's also worth waiting a little bit to see where that's going.
All right. Debbie?
Looks like I did a quick check. It is indeed next week, June 11th through 15th, is Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. So, yeah, for a Mac, definitely wait till next week to buy.
Okay. Let's take a call. We have a caller on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. I just tuned in a few minutes ago and heard you say something about that the Windows XP is really not that secure. What is the later version that I should be running?
Well, and I'm not going to say that it's insecure necessarily, but it's certainly not getting the attention. There have been two Windows operating systems released since XP. Well, yeah, I think so. If I'm counting right, I may just ignore the ones I didn't like. I don't know. there's definitely been Vista,
yeah.
And there's definitely been Windows 7. I guess there was that terrible one between 98 and 2000.
It was Windows 2000.
Millennium.
Oh, Millennium.
Yeah, that was the terrible one that nobody wants to remember.
No.
But that was so there's been XP, Vista, and then Windows 7.
Oh.
I run Windows 7 on all of the machines that I have Windows on. I'm very happy with it. It takes more hardware to run than an older XP machine, so you know it's not an option for everybody to upgrade to it. But like I said, my personal choice is that I would not want to be running an XP machine surfing the internet right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks very much for the call. I wanted to get into the Mac v. PC debate a little bit. I know this is a subject a lot of folks have brought up before, and maybe this is a time to talk a little bit about the personalities of the two operating systems, or at least the users of those particular types of computers. I took the plunge and bought a new laptop some months back. Before I did, I posted a quick note on Facebook saying, okay, Mac or PC, have at it. And my goodness, the response was outrageous. Especially, it seemed, from Mac users, going on and on gushing about Macs. We have a Mac user here. Debbie, why is it is there an emotional connection for Mac users?
Well, the cynic in me says they paid more for their computer, so they've got to justify it somehow. Practically speaking, I even know Windows people that like the hardware well enough, and if they've got the money, they'll buy the hardware and run Windows on it, because the Mac hardware is usually, they've had a few mistakes, but usually pretty rock solid hardware. And like the current cases are solid aluminum, they withstand a lot, they work pretty well. The operating system, if you would have asked me, you know, 6-7 years ago, I would have told you why, unless you needed a PC specific application, the Mac OS was a little bit easier to use for most people. It was back then much easier to learn if you weren't computer savvy. Yeah, the interface. That's not nearly as true. XP started it on Vista, and you know, even 98. Vista and 7 have really done it. It's just about as easy to use a Windows machine. You got to be a little more careful. Be sure you've got your antivirus stuff installed. But Macs aren't immune, as we all heard about in the last couple months. They don't get as many, but they do get them.
Is it that they're easier to operate, or is it that we have all collectively become a bit more computer savvy in recent years?
I'd say a little bit of both, but Windows 7 is a lot friendlier and a lot easier to use than Windows 98 was, or certainly like Windows 3.1 or DOS, right? When in the early Mac days. You know, today, you know, you look at your budget and you figure out what you can afford. I really like my Mac, but partly it's because also what you're used to. You know, I've been a Mac user for a really long time, and so it's easier for me to find my way around the Mac stuff. It's, you know, it's quicker for me to do things. I do a lot of stuff with Unix computers, so having some tools like Perl and Telnet and SSH and a shell all built in, and it's been that way for the last 10 years. That's not something new. That makes my life easy. With Windows, you can get a lot of those things, but you have to add them on. I'm not as sure about 7, but I know at least prior to 7, you know, you'd had to add your SSH client, you had to add your Perl, you have to add all those things in. And so for me, the pointy-clicky stuff where I want to use Word or Excel or something like that because somebody sends me a file, it's there, and the Unix-y stuff is there, and it just works really well, and I don't have to think too hard about it. I want to think about other things.
Jim, as a guy who navigates both, but I guess maybe you'd identify yourself as more of a PC user, where do you stand on this? Do you feel passionately one way or another about Mac versus PC?
The only passionate part I have is about calling bunk on Mac people that tell me they're so great and so much better than Windows. Because as a user of both, and I actually own Windows and Mac machines at home, I like to pick the right tool for the job. But I find that, you know, it used to be, and I don't disagree with this, that especially before Windows XP, you know, Windows crashes, blah, 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 all that. Programs can bring down the whole operating system. Well, I've seen programs bring down Macs too and other issues. So, I don't think that stability is an argument anymore on those. One of the reasons I think initially, that Apples were considered easier is I think Apple reduces the number of choices you have, so you don't feel overwhelmed by the ways you can do things in the Mac OS as opposed to Windows. I mean, they only give you one button. The mouse button now allows you to do a lot of stuff with two fingers and multiple things, but originally there was just one button. So, you know, just that part, because Windows people, I mean, think about your mother or your grandmother who's never got a computer and somebody buys her one for Christmas. You know, you're given in your little, you know, some little nerdy relative like me is trying to help and you're whipping through stuff going left click there, right click there, left click, drag, hold, control, hold shift, and stuff like that. And it's overwhelming. Now, Apple had a lot of that stuff, which, you know, hold the command key, the alt key, the option key, and things like that. But for day-to-day stuff, you don't need those buttons very often. You just need one mouse button, although I still like using two to do shortcuts and things. But it was just fewer options, fewer choices to get stuff done. This is the way you did it. Three people didn't show you four different ways of doing things.
That really was the old thing. But these days, I think Windows is just as easy to use. I mean, I like my Mac, but at this point, it's mostly because I'm used to it.
We're due to take a short break, and we will have more of your phone calls for Deb Flagger and Jim Irick in just a few moments. It's our monthly computer show here on Focus.
Pink slime has been in the news recently, but have you heard of meat glue?
Meat glue is an enzyme that the meat industry has been using for a while. It's used to sort of fuse two pieces of meat together and make them appear as if it's one piece of meat.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Philpott, the food and ag blogger for Mother Jones magazine, talks about the meat industry. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
And welcome back to Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Craig Cohen, sitting in this hour for David Inge. On the first Thursday of each month, we like to open up the phones to give you a chance to ask any and all questions you might have about computers, from the latest hardware and software to online issues to antivirus programs to troubleshooting any issues you might be having with your Mac or your PC, whichever one it may be. My guests are Debbie Flagger and Jim Irick from the University of Illinois. Debbie works for Sites, or Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services. They're the folks that keep the U of I campus computer network running smoothly despite having to put up with users like me. And then Jim works for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the U of I and is probably grateful that he and his staff really don't have to deal with folks like me. We welcome your computer questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And let's take another call. Line 2 is in Urbana. Good morning.
Yes, just a tiny caveat. Millennium didn't come out after Windows XP preceded.
Right. It was from 98 to Millennium to 2000 to XP.
Right. So it's 2 and 1 pending. And it looks like 8 will be out almost any time by the end of the year, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, Windows 8 is certainly coming soon. I don't know if there's an exact date yet. Public review is out. They have not sent a Gold Master to manufacturers yet, but I expect that to happen shortly.
The reviews seem more favorable as time goes on from what I've seen. Is that your impression?
It is. I have not seen it yet. I do plan on buying a new laptop after July, and I will either use it as my testbed or my old laptop and put the public trial or the test on it and see how it goes. Some of the initial reviews were talking about just the new interface, and I'm not sure I'm sold on that. I like the old interface, so we'll see.
Well, I hate changing interfaces too, but I've gotten to like 7 pretty well, and it's only been a couple of months. But
7 honestly is not that much different all the way back from 95.
Not really. No, you're right. A few minor differences that could be aggravating for a couple of days, but that was it.
Right.
All right. Thanks very much for
Thank
the call.
You.
You know, this reminds me, though, how I would love to see at some point something like what the post office has done. You know how they sell their forever stamps?
Oh, I love those.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about the next time they raise the prices. Why doesn't Windows just do that, put out a Windows Forever product, operating system, that will never have to be updated?
Well, it'll have to be updated because you will find you can never – no piece of software can be perfect. And there will always – you'll either find – you'll have people that find security problems in it, which then the vulnerabilities and things that you need to fix, or your users find strange ways of breaking it that need fixed. Performance enhancements come out, plus new hardware comes out. And then if you actually came up with something like that, if they release an operating system that did everything that Windows 7 or Windows 8 is going to do, except for it looked like Windows 95,
mm-hmm.
people would make fun of it and say that don't buy this because it's like we're running in the 90s again.
Fair point.
And so people want fresh and new and some new stuff. Part of the operating system, and I have not worked with either Mountain Lion nor the new window, the previews of Windows 8, but my understanding is both operating systems are pushing closer and closer towards like mobile touch interfaces. I keep hearing that Apple's going to, it's like a MacBook will actually just be a giant iPhone operating system with a keyboard. I'm not sure I like that. So we'll see where it goes. I think they're still going to need power users out there that want to be able to tweak things and do whatever they want. And maybe Linux is going to be the place to go for that.
Debbie?
Well, I would say for what I've seen so far on Mountain Lion, that Lion was where they did that. Mountain Lion doesn't look to be taking it to yet a whole nother level.
Okay.
From what I've seen so far.
We have some more folks on the line. Let's go next to line 1 in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. A little while ago, Jim said he kept both PC and Mac because he liked the right tool for the job. I'd like to hear which jobs each is appropriate for.
Well, for me, I own a single Mac Mini. And it is a home theater PC connected to my television and my network. And I use it to surf video content on the internet and also my own video and music collection at home.
Oh.
There's a very nice program, open source program out there called Plex, P-L-E-X, that's free to download. And it creates a TV-sized interface that I can use with an infrared remote control. And therefore, I can surf videos or music through my computer, and then it plays out of my stereo system.
So that largely for entertainment and the other one for business?
Well, for me, it's that way. A lot of what I do is most of my consulting. In fact, I don't know any of my consulting customers that have Mac computers right now. So all my consulting work that I do on my own time at home is other Windows machines, and it's a lot easier to administrate a Windows machine from a Windows machine. If I had a Mac, if I had Mac customers, I would have Mac to do that, because honestly, it is definitely easier to remote desktop from one Mac to another Mac.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. Line 3 is also in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. I have a question. We have an old computer, and it's 8 years old. It's a Dell desktop. It's running XP. And recently we've been getting a message that says low battery volume or something like that. And, you know, it says hit F1, and then we get in. Does that mean we need to replace the battery for the backup or whatever keeps the machine knowing what time and date and all of that is?
That's exactly the battery it's probably talking about, which is it's often called the BIOS battery.
Okay.
I don't know the last time I saw one of those messages, but I don't remember the last time I kept a machine for 7 years.
Yeah.
Normally those are just a small little coin battery like you put in a watch or like a hearing aid. Usually they're about the size of the ones that go in watches and little electronic toys like Pocket Yahtzee, things like that. You can, and Dell has great documentation for even their older machines. So if you go to the Dell support site and put in either your express service code or your Dell service tag, it'll tell you, how the machine was built, all the parts that are in it, and you should be able to find documentation on replacing that battery.
And it's something we could do ourselves.
You know, I think so. It depends. Some motherboards have the BIOS battery is actually soldered on. So if you can solder, you can replace it. Otherwise, you could take it somewhere. And some of them have a little holder that you can take a tiny jeweler screwdriver or and pop that old battery out of there and stick a new one in there.
What happens if that battery does die?
So not much that I can think of. I think the battery only keeps the clock going anymore. It was more settings than that. I mean, it would actually remember hard drives and settings. But anymore, I think all it does is keep is your computer will lose time when it comes up.
Well, the problem that we're having recently is it doesn't want to boot back up, so we've been having to leave it on.
Right, because it tells you every time you boot up that the BIOS battery needs replaced.
Right, but it's not only that, but it won't even, it just nothing comes up, so then we have to go reinstall stuff to get it to come back up again. So,
that sounds like other problems.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was related to the battery or not.
It's hard to say.
It might be related to the age of the computer, though, right?
Agreed.
Yeah.
7 years old is a long time to trust a single hard drive
to not fail. That's what I was going to ask, too, is we've been talking about replacing it, and you're saying probably wait till July to look at new laptops or new desktops.
Yeah, I think that because what I expect to happen, and honestly, I'm sorry, I don't have the dates on when all these new Intel products are going to be coming out, so I don't know. But it's the same policies or the same things going to apply as when Apple releases new hardware. The old hardware is going to drop prices. So whether you're looking for cutting edge or whether or not you're just going to buy what's out there today or, you know, from 3 months ago, the prices are still going to be lower. If you have a need to go buy a machine, you know, if you can't wait, don't
right.
wait, because there's always something new there's always something over the horizon when it comes to tech.
Yeah.
But if you can actually wait a little longer, I think in this case, it'll be better off because I think the price drops are going to be really good, or you're going to be able to buy the newer stuff, and you're going to be happy with it.
But I would suspect that the part of the argument that you'll be, you know, have more newer applications maybe doesn't apply so much in this case, because if you're replacing a computer that's 7 or 8 years old, pretty much anything is going to look great.
Well, I don't disagree with that. Sure. I agree. So if the 7-year-old machine is, but if you're a person that replaces every 3 years, wait. If for a 7-year-old machine, maybe just look out there and find out, you know, get a decently spec machine to replace it. Maybe look on some of the places that they list deals. You know, a store has you know, next weekend has a $150 dad's weekend or whatever, whenever Father's Day is coming up, I know, because all these emails I've been getting lately, you know, that they have a sale that weekend. Maybe that's a good time to get one.
Well, Well, sometimes they'll also, and this is true with box stores, it's true with various websites, they'll offer sales, but they'll offer with very specific conditions, like Windows might come preloaded on the computer or something like that. Are there reasons to be concerned about preloaded software versus getting it the software a hard copy of it separately?
I don't even ask Dell to send me the disks anymore for Windows 7.
Okay.
I mean, if you're a home user, maybe, because you might have to reinstall. But, yeah, and so that one you need to research per manufacturer. In the past, I've worked with customers that, and I'm not going to name names of the manufacturers, but there were certain manufacturers that were terrible about this. Basically, when you open up your computer, the first thing you had to do was buy 10 blank disks and burn a bunch of CDs so that you had copies of the software that came with it.
Right.
Whereas other vendors were very good at, as long as you said yes, charge me the $12, then they would send you a disk of everything that was on the computer when you bought it, or you could download it from their website.
All right, let's go next to line 2 in Urbana. Good morning. Okay.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, my question has to do with, I'd like to get some expert opinion about the relationship between anonymity and security on the Internet. You know, we spend huge resources protecting ourselves from all these viruses and bots and things on the Internet, and the people who write these programs that are a problem, it seems that the punishment, you know, millions of computers are affected, millions of dollars are spent protecting and responding to these attacks. I'd just like some expert opinion, you know, some expert comment about the relationship between anonymity and the cost of some of the security software that we have to have. And I'll hang up and just listen to your comments.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Well, you know, there are a couple of things there. One of them is, how much should you spend to secure your computer? You know, there are some antivirus programs out there that are free and downloadable and of various quality. And then there are some that you can pay an arm and a leg for. And so the question is, what works, what doesn't, and how much should all of this really cost us collectively?
On my personal machines, I don't pay for antivirus software. The family machines that I maintain, I use Windows, Microsoft's Security Essentials, free download for Microsoft. I have not had much issue with that. There's a couple of other, if a machine gets infected, I'll download other free tools. But in general, the only time that I have customers pay for antivirus is to get the better automatic updates. In a larger enterprise, you're paying for antivirus, but you could also go with lower cost solutions. But when you have 100 machines, you don't want to go to each one to take care of stuff. And you pay a lot of money in order to automate those and manage that.
Debbie, there's the cost on the front end of trying to protect your computer from viruses. But then there's also, of course, the cost on the other end, where if you do end up with a computer virus that wreaks havoc and you need to either reinstall software or buy new software or buy a new computer, there are all kinds of costs associated with it afterwards. What do we do about this in sort of the grand scheme of things? Is there anything to be done?
Well, I think the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, applies very heavily to viruses. It's much easier to take the time to install an antivirus software, and as Jim mentioned, there's some good free products out there, either by Microsoft or there's some others. Install it, set it up to do its updates, and that takes a little bit of your time. You're unlikely to spend more than 2 hours for most people getting it set up on any one computer. Big enterprises are a different issue, but for your personal computer at home, having spent that 2 hours and you make sure it runs, you're protected. You know, as long as it gets its updates, it should do a pretty darn good job of keeping you safe. And you can spend days, hours, or weeks. The worst kind of virus for the two really bad things you're worried about as an end user is if they get your passwords, especially to things like your credit card websites or things like that, out of your computer with key logging or something, and you know, actually can compromise you, or something that erases your hard drive and loses your work, whatever that work may be. I mean, those are the two worst cases I can think of off the top of my head. Both of those are huge amounts of time to recover from, if you can recover from them entirely.
Some antivirus programs will indicate if you're, let's say you do a Google search online, it'll tell you this particular search result is protected. This one is pretty good. This one, we don't know anything about this site. You maybe shouldn't click there. How do you know? Should you pay attention to that? Can we trust the quality of those antivirus programs to tell us?
I've never used one of those toolbars. I've heard of them. In general, I think that I personally think that I could probably not have an antivirus or any anti-malware on a machine, and I would not get infected. I look at what the biggest one that we see infection for machines are people purposely downloading files and running them, and not emails, looking at emails, but actually clicking on links in emails, and paying attention and going, oh no, that's not right. And when you look at it, or you get an email from if you get an email from your credit card company that says click here, or your bank says click here to go do this, don't. Either call them up with the number that's on the back of the credit card, or go to Google or your browser and type in Chase or JP Morgan or whatever, and go to their website and log into your account yourself. Don't follow links in emails to get to those things. Even if it's a legit email, I don't, because you just don't know. I mean, they're the people that send out the email spam that tries to trick you into stealing your bank accounts and things like that. They're good at making it look like the real ones. And so I just go to, like I said, I go to Chase or American Express or whatever and log in myself. And if they sent me a message, when I log in, it'll be in the inbox for my account and tell me they sent me a message, and then I know it's legitimate.
To the LinkedIn thing we talked about this morning, I read a little bit on it, and they said they will send you a mail. If you were compromised, they'll send you a piece of mail, and there will be no links in it. It'll tell you what to do, but there will be no links in it. So even the companies are trying to keep you safe. I got a piece of spam yesterday or the day before that said, your Twitter account's been activated. And when you read really closely, you were being redirected to TVVITTER. It looks like nice. A W when you read it quickly. They're really crafty people out there trying to get you to click on things you shouldn't.
And as far as the users, the callers' concern about, and I don't know about when you get into security and being anonymous on the internet, but as far as surfing with some measure of that, I use a browser add-in called Do Not Track Plus that prevents and stops a lot of the tracking cookies and things that are on web pages. And I just looked, and so far it says, and this is a laptop I don't do a lot of surfing on because it's just for work. It says that I have blocked over 1,000 companies from tracking me while I've been surfing.
We have a few more folks on the line. I want to try to get to as many calls as we can in our final minutes. Let's go next to line one in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. I am one of those people who have a 6-year-old laptop, and I can't afford to replace it real soon. I'm running XP. I'm looking online at 7, and it looks like I can download it for relatively cheaply. Is it worth it to go ahead and do that now?
So 6-year-old laptop, I'm not sure I'd try to run Windows 7 on it. It may not have the system resources necessary to do it in a way that you would find acceptable. The other concern I have is actually being able to download Microsoft operating system. And make sure you're doing that through Microsoft.com. There are a lot of scam sites out there that will provide you with either, it'll just be infected, it'll just be some sort of malware, or... it will be a pirated copy of Windows 7 that eventually Microsoft will send a patch out that updates it. And then it says, oh, look, you were actually running an illegitimate copy. You can no longer get updates and do stuff on your computer.
Okay.
So be very careful about downloading operating system software off the internet.
Gotcha. It does say my machine was Vista capable. Does that tell you any more about if 7 is going to be...
I think Microsoft might actually make a tool that you can download that'll test to see if Windows 7 will run or not.
Okay.
Let me see. But in general, yes, I would feel comfortable if a device said that it could probably run Vista. I don't know that the system resources of Windows 7 are that much worse, or greater, I should say, not worse, greater than Vista. But I would look on the internet. I don't have time right now to find it, but I think there might be something called like a Windows 7 migration analyzer.
Okay.
that you can download from, and it'll be a Microsoft.com site that you can download and run, and it'll tell you how it thinks Windows 7 would run on your computer.
All right. Thanks very much for that call. I think we have just enough time maybe for one more call. Line 2 is in Champaign. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have a misbehaving iMac. I'm wondering if there are any keystrokes during startup that will take me to the OS X utilities.
Debbie, any ideas?
There's are you running Lion or something older?
It's Lion.
Okay, so if you're running Lion and you hold down the Option key while you're booting, it should show you your regular hard drive and a recovery partition. If you go to the recovery partition, you should have a limited access to some of the disk utility type tools.
All right, I appreciate that. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks very much for the call. And we are just about at the end of our time, and I guess we haven't solved the Mac PC debate, but I don't know if that was really our goal for the hour anyways.
Find out what your most knowledgeable, nerdy, geeky friends use and get that one so you can ask them for help.
That is the perfect answer.
That's a great idea. I want to say thank you to our guests this morning. Debbie Flagger is a network engineer for Campus Information Technologies and Education Services, or CITES, here at the University of Illinois. Debbie, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome.
And James Irick is a security engineer at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. Jim, thank you for being with us as
well.
Thank you. On tomorrow's program, we will hear another archived conversation that David Inge had with Ann Heller, a journalist and author of Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll listen back to a conversation with James McManus, an American poker player and author of Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. That's on tomorrow's Focus.